It's been 25 years since the ATF began surveillance on a religious compound near Waco, Texas, that was home to David Koresh and the Branch Davidians after the ATF had learned that they were stockpiling and illegally modifying weapons. The ATF then conducted a failed raid on the compound that left four federal agents dead, six Branch Davidians dead, and several others on both sides wounded. This led to a 51-day standoff between the FBI and the religious group that, as many know, ended in tragedy when the compound burned to the ground. Joining us now, the FBI's chief negotiator during the standoff and author of the book Stalling for Time, Gary Nesner. All right, Gary, looking at all the different elements involved in this situation, it makes it a pretty unique situation. We got David Koresh and his extremely powerful influence over the Branch Davidians. We have a shootout with the ATF that left casualties on both sides, and David had actually prophesied the U.S. government coming to attack the compound before. So with all this in mind, how do you approach this situation? What's going on through your head as a negotiator?
Well, you've correctly summarized the sort of factors that I think helped make this one of the, if not the most challenging situation anyone's had to face in terms of a negotiation. And, you know, what you have to recognize as a negotiator is that you can't turn back the hands of time and make a bad situation better. So your focus really has to move beyond the loss of life and the high emotional content that's taken place and try to calm things down and create a relationship of trust where you can work to make sure that no one else gets killed. So that's the pretty clear focus of your activities, and that's what our team tried to do.
Now, you guys came up with a pretty cool strategy to let them kind of know that we're all just humans, and where you actually videotaped yourselves and talked about how you guys had families of your own, and you guys sent those videos into the compound. Could you tell us a little bit more about this strategy, and what kind of response did you receive from it?
Yeah, it was interesting. As I recall the sequence, in one of the conversations, David Koresh or his deputy, Steve Snyder, mentioned that they had sort of made cartoon drawings of what they thought we looked like. And we picked up on that, and we were thinking to ourselves, well, maybe to humanize ourselves, we'll send a videotape in. And what we decided to do is record the, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 10 negotiators who up to that point in time had spoken with folks inside, including myself. And we videotaped ourselves delivering an upbeat, positive message of cooperation and intent to make sure they all came out alive and a concern for their families. And most of us showed pictures of our own families as a, you know, additional boost to that approach. And I think it was quite effective.
All right, Gary, we talked about the different elements in this situation that made for a pretty tough assignment, but let's add one more. The negotiation team and the tactical team were utilizing completely different strategies. Just kind of tell us what was going on, what was the tactical team doing, and how did it affect things on the negotiation side?
Yeah, we had two different approaches, and that's a departure from what was even then longstanding FBI policy and principles that in a crisis, the tactical negotiation components who report to an on-scene decision maker really have to speak from the same sheet of music. They may have different recommendations they make to the on-scene commander, but once a decision has been made to pursue a certain strategy, then people need to line up that. What we ended up having was an aberrant command structure where the tactical folks sort of pursued a more aggressive, in-your-face demonstration of their frustration to sort of compel the Davidians to comply and come out, whereas we as negotiators realized that would be counterproductive. We needed to create a relationship of trust and convince them to come out. So that was ended up being a huge impediment to our ability to stay on track and get the sort of resolution that we'd hoped for. We did get 35 people out, including 21 children, but the ill-timed and often inappropriate tactical initiatives were a real obstacle to achieving the ultimate success we wanted.
Okay, and just tell us some of the things the tactical team was doing. They were conducting psyops. Kind of tell us what was that all about?
Well, you know, it's sort of idle hands, the devil's workshop. You know, we had a very highly trained tactical team, the FBI's elite hostage rescue team, and they're used to being very dynamic and going in and conducting a hostage rescue. And in this incident, day after day, week after week, they're sitting there waiting with really nothing to do. And I think some of that frustration manifested itself in some of the things they did. They played the loud music, as you mentioned. That is a strongly not an FBI negotiation tool that's recommended. In fact, is usually counterproductive and makes us look foolish, and as it did in this case. They went forward with armored vehicles and crushed cars or, disrupted the outside area, engaged in, demonstrations of anger and frustration. And, you know, when you're a negotiator on the phone and trying to create a relationship of trust and say, you know, to David Koresh or company, hey, you can trust me and depend on me. I'll do what I say and you'll be treated fairly. And then you look out your window and a tank is crushing your car. It's hard to, it's hard to make that argument that we're there to be helpful.
God, it's wild to hear you talk about kind of the philosophy and the psychology before it, because it's like on a grand scale, just little arguments you have with people. If you're going to come at them with just anger and, you know, a sense of power, I feel like in every day-to-day arguments, this whole this conversation is changing my life here. But could you tell us?
Well,
we see it
in our political discourse today.
Yeah,
we quickly want to demonize our enemy. I mean, there's no question David Koresh was an extraordinarily challenging character. He was very manipulative, and he'd say things and do something else or make representations and not follow through. And, you know, he tried to manipulate and control not only his loyal followers, but us as well. And that's frustrating. As a negotiator, I'm kind of used to that. I think the tactical people are not. And, there's sort of that traditional, hey, I told you what to do and you're not doing it, so now I'm going to make you do it.
Yeah, totally.
Well, you know, when you have women and children and innocent lives, that you're just going to have to adapt to a different, less aggressive approach. But yeah, we see it throughout life when people get very angry and when they disagree with someone and use that to demonize them in general. I mean, you see it in our political discourse. Oh, you guys are all libtards, or you're a knuckle dragging conservative. You know, whatever it is, we throw names at each other. We pigeonhole people into boxes that allow us to discount everything they say, instead of looking for, ground in the middle and areas of potential agreement. We seem to be in a rush these days to find areas to discount the person and delegitimize their position.
Yeah, no,
it's an obstacle to cooperation.
That's a profound thoughts, and even as a philosophy for life, you can kind of hold on to that and keep it close to you, and it'll help you in day to day, see eye to eye with someone, you know, maybe learn something new about yourself. I love it, man. I got another question here for you. Tell us about Steve Schneider and his relationship with David Koresh. What did you learn about Steve, and how did you implement that as part of your strategy?
Yeah, David Koresh was a learning disability. He wasn't particularly well educated. He was able to memorize large parts of the Bible and impressed his followers with that ability. Steve Schneider, on the other hand, had a master's and was working on a PhD in theology. He was very articulate, very bright, well educated, well spoken, much more so than Koresh. And there was also an issue of some years prior to the incident, Koresh had decided that he would have exclusive sexual access to all the women, and he fathered the child with Steve Schneider's wife, Judy, and they had been unable to have a child for many years. So we sensed in Steve Schneider conflict, that he was loyal to David on one hand, and on the other hand, you know, this was a wife that he loved and a child now that he cared for, but he wasn't the father of. And we tried to sort of mildly put a wedge between the two, because we always felt that Schneider was a reasonable person, and if we had been able to negotiate with him, we would have solved the whole situation. I mean, in fact, early on, David Koresh had been wounded in the initial shootout, and, you know, frankly, we were hoping he would get septicemia and die, because had he done so, there's absolutely no question in any informed person's mind that we would have convinced Steve Snyder to lead everybody out alive.
All right, Gary, so we've been negotiating for days and even weeks now, and David finally agrees to come out, but under one condition, and this is kind of a strange deal that you guys made. Tell us, what deal was that?
Well, he wanted to have a message broadcast to the world,
and about his basic interpretation of the Book of Revelation, that very mysterious part of the Bible that is very dark and widely interpreted in very different ways. And so we were, however, concerned that, this would be a precursor to a suicide, that he would say his last bit and take everybody with him a la Jonestown. So we, instead of giving him live coverage, asked him to prepare a take recording. And he did. It's 58 minutes. We listened to it and showed it, presented it to the religious department at Baylor University, and asked them to look at it and listen to it, rather, and make sure that it didn't contain anything suicidal in there. And it didn't. And we asked Koresh, to incorporate within the statement a promise to come out if indeed this was played, very clearly, unambiguously. So we did all those things. And then we set up the process through which the orderly exit from the compound would take place. We went through it in great detail. Everybody agreed to it. It was a sort of derived at in a cooperative way. And yet when time came, Koresh had a vision from God that said he was to wait. So, a skeptic might doubt that God actually spoke to him at that time, but, who am I to say? But it was certainly irritating and extraordinarily disappointing to we as negotiators. But as negotiators, we're used to people saying they're going to do one thing and something else, and we don't necessarily overreact to it. Whereas the on-scene commander and the tactical commander really took it personally and, ordered tanks forward to do things that were made it even worse. So this is kind of emotion that you deal with in these situations when people... We have a saying in negotiations, don't get even, get your way. So, try to put aside your personal frustration with someone's statements or activities and instead focus on the task at hand. And that flipped away in this particular incident. I would have preferred a strategy rather than moving forward with armored vehicles and punishing him for not coming out. I would have used it again and again to say to them, hey, we did everything you said. We promised. We upheld our side of the bargain. We're the good guys here. And, I went out on a limb to let you play this. I convinced my boss for you to play this. And then you turned around and you didn't do it. So how am I supposed to help you if that's what you're going to do? That would be the approach that you would really hammer away endlessly.
Okay. And so even after the agreement to come out, David, you guys made this final agreement. I believe there's some lawyers involved that were allowed onto the compound to talk to him. And they said once he was done writing his version of the seven seals, the FBI, he would then come out. However, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't interrupt you before you finished the question. But, in essence, that's what happened. Now, I was gone by that time and had been replaced. But nonetheless, that is what happened. Not only did we send in the negotiator tape, we sent in tape of the kids that had been released. We did a lot of really innovative things that had never been done in the negotiations. And one of the things we did was allow two attorneys, defense attorneys, to go in to essentially a crime scene. I mean, you just don't do that. It's like a bank robber's holding hostages and you send his attorneys in to talk to him. It's just unprecedented. But we did it. And of course, they came out and they said, hey, well, as soon as he writes the seven seals, we're good to go. Now, that sort of put a stop on everything the FBI was doing. And this is, probably in the day 40 or something by now.
And then as the passing days went by, we found out from Steve Snyder and others that he hadn't begun. He hadn't begun to write the seal. Nobody had seen him. He refused to send us out any proof that he'd been working on them. And
command at the time in the FBI became convinced that he was just stalling and it was a ruse. And so that's what I think helped rationalize in their minds that, you know, short of assaulting the building, the only option really law enforcement had and has to this day is putting in gas to force people out. And I don't know that the way the plan was implemented was well thought out of, but that was their thinking.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I guess the FBI, they went to Janet Reno and President Clinton and told them that they feared that children were going to be abused if they were in there much longer. And the FBI, at this point, the tactical team had completely lost any patience they had. So when you found out they were going to go in with CS gas, did you hear about that? And what was going through your mind?
Well, I did. After I left Waco at the halfway point, I went overseas for something else. And I came back a day or two before the tear gas insertion on April 19th of 93 and was told by my boss that I was either going to be sent back to Waco or that they were going to be putting in tear gas. And the next day he called me up and said, don't come into work, just go to FBI headquarters to the command post. They're going to put in tear gas. So that's where I really heard about it. And, you know, what happened at the time, they didn't talk to Clinton, but they did go to Reno, Attorney General Janet Reno, and they did present that there was ongoing abuse. Now, you know, I can't say that that wasn't happening, but there's no question David Koresh had had sex with underage girls, including some as young as 12. We had no contemporary information that that was still ongoing. And frankly, I think a valid criticism could be that knowing that Janet Reno was particularly focused in her prosecutive career before becoming an attorney general on children's affairs, that that card might have been played as a real powerful card to convince her to support that plan, and she did. And, you know, obviously nobody foresaw how it was going to end. But, I think the frustration levels rose so high, and they felt they could be there for months and months more, if not longer, and Koresh was just not going to come out. And there wasn't a lot of tools left.
It's an insane situation. I mean, that whole thing. And it's interesting to hear someone, Gary, like you, who has, you know, a calming presence, calming voice. And I guess does a lot of that come naturally, or how much like training did you have to kind of, you know, because we're all about helping each other in this community. And you know, what you probably learned as a negotiator is probably what we could all learn to get, you know, a little bit better discourse within the ranks of just being human beings to each other. So could you enlighten us a little bit on that, maybe?
Well, you know, I think some of it is, you know, a natural personality. I see some of it, you know, I saw some of it in my father. He just was the kind of guy that always looked at a complex problem in a calm, reasonable way and didn't allow his emotions to dictate his behavior, and I think I inherited some of that. But and then also a lot of it's learned and appreciated that, you know, in order for me to influence you or anybody else, I have to be in control of my own emotions. In fact, in my book, Stalling for Time, you know, I begin chapters with various quotes, and I have a partial quote from Rudyard Kipling in one of the chapters, and it's, you know, if you can keep your head about you when all else are losing theirs. I mean, I think that sort of denotes the attribute of a really good negotiator, that rather than allowing your emotions to impede your rational thought and behavior, it's not that you don't feel the emotions, you just control it. And, you know, it's kind of like a trauma surgeon sees a, you know, a young child come in that's really badly mangled and may not live. Well, you know, rather than sitting there and crying and you know, wallowing in the terrible tragedy of it all, the surgeon doesn't have the luxury. You just got to get to work to try to save this child's life. And I think that's what a negotiator does. You just say, hey, this is a really bad situation, and there's lives on the line here, but I can't allow my emotions to impede my clear thinking in terms of trying to convince this person I'm here to help them, and it's not only in my best interest, but their best interest to cooperate. So I think all of us could benefit from that in life, whether we're having arguments with our children, our spouses, our friends and coworkers. You know, we always have the saying that listening is the cheapest concession anyone can make. So you just calmly and quietly allow that other person to to express what is bothering them and how they feel about it. And by acknowledging that and paraphrasing it, you really tell them, hey, I hear what you're saying. I understand how you feel. It's an enormously powerful tool of social influence.
We could learn a lot from you, Gary, really. We could. I had another question real quick. Did you by chance watch the six-part series of Waco?
Yes. You know, I was involved in that. And, you know, my book rights for Stalling for Time were purchased as one of the two books for the basis of that. The other was a Waco book written by David Thibodeau, one of the Branch Davidian survivors. So I was a consultant and, you know, on set and with the scripts and so forth. And, you know, I think they did a good job. I think they tended to paint Koresh a little too sympathetically because probably that's because Taylor Kitsch is such a wonderful actor. And
yeah, he did a great job.
He plays such a wonderful role, and it's so sympathetic. But I can't complain because I had Michael Shannon play me, you know, twice Academy Award nominated actor, you know, who's just simply amazing.
That's great.
And I think did an incredible job. So it was a lot of fun being involved in the project. I think they tried to do a real fair and balanced approach of what it was like inside looking out and what it was outside looking in. And, you know, might have been some things I would have changed, but overall, I think they did a fine job.
Yeah, I think Michael Shannon did a great job, and you were probably just watching the, like, yep, that's me right there. That's definitely me.
Well, I don't think he was trying to imitate me to the extent that Taylor was trying to imitate Koresh, but,
oh, yeah.
But you know, he certainly put his own mark on it, and we spent a lot of time together and got to be friends, and I he's just this amazing actor, and it's really quite phenomenal to see somebody who can express so much thought and emotion with just a look or a facial expression. I mean, beyond the dialogue, he's just a powerful on-screen presence, and I was really delighted and fortunate that he played Gary Nestner on the screen.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. They'd probably pick, like, Matthew Lillard or someone to play me, someone with just,
I still got it on my DVR, actually. It's great.
Yeah, so.
Well, right. I'm just lucky Danny DeVito was tied up on other projects.
Oh,
yeah, definitely. All right, so Stalling for Time, your book, it sounds amazing. And now, is most of it, we've been talking most about Waco. Is your book, I'm sure, incorporates all of the hostage negotiations that you've had over the years. Is there any negotiation that kind of sticks out in your head? Either, you know, I would have done this differently, or one that didn't get as much as the publicity as Waco?
Well, there's several in there. I talk about prison riots and skyjacking and different incidents I worked through the years. And I try to be candid about what I thought we did well and also what mistakes were made. But, you know, it's a personal journey of my growth as a human being and a negotiator, but it's also a story about the, you know, the growth of negotiation especially within law enforcement. You know, it only started in the mid 70s. So, you know, it's come a long way and saved perhaps more lives than any single thing law enforcement has ever come up with. And, you know, the concept of diffusing a tense situation and steering people away from violence, you know, no one can even begin to calculate how many lives have been saved, not only nationally, but internationally, because we've taught this all over the world. So it's pretty powerful stuff. I think Waco is certainly the biggest and most prominent chapter in the book, but one that's largely unknown and shouldn't be is 3 years later, we had an 85-day standoff in Montana with an anti-government group called the Freemen. And in that instance, on the heels or ashes of Waco, as it were, you know, the FBI director then, Louis Free, said, hey, he said, Gary, you tell us the way to go forward on this, and that's the strategy we're going to do. And so in that case, unlike Waco, the negotiation strategy prevailed, which it should, absent, you know, other indicators. We should always take the least violent course of action. And after 85 days, everybody came out, no shots fired, nobody injured. And it was a great, I think, validation and testament to the fact that, you know, that's how we should have done it in Waco and been given the support to do it the right way. And it validated the whole approach of negotiations. I was very proud of that. But, of course, since no one died, no fires, you know, it kind of fell off the news, the news screen. But it's addressed pretty thoroughly in my book.
Oh, that's awesome.
Well, Gary, we're going to let you go because I know you're probably a busy guy, and thank you so much for talking to us. But this show we're on, this is a very pro-liberty show. We talk a lot about Second Amendment rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, just overall being free and just minding your own business. Don't do anything that hurts anybody else, and everybody's okay. And I think the Waco story really encompasses all of that. So it's been amazing hearing your side of the story, and I can't thank you enough for talking to us today.
Well, you're more than welcome.
All right, Gary, have a good one.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye. Bye.